Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Tucker Troutman. My number is 4047. And I'm going to focus, if you will, on an unusual aspect of this case. The appellee, WREP, Waddles Real Estate, has essentially conceded the two legal errors that we allege the trial court made, but maintains that they didn't matter and that this court should nonetheless affirm. They do matter, as we've argued in our briefs, and for my time up here, I want to focus on a couple of points, answer any of your questions, and then reserve time for rebuttal after counsel has argued. There are four key agreements in this case, which are discussed in the briefs and form the basis of the legal arguments. Let me briefly put them into context for you. First one is the loan agreement between my client, GECC, and Ultimate Acquisition Partners, known as UAP, which was executed in September of 2005, giving GECC an enforceable security interest in the subject property. As relevant here, the security agreement granted a security interest in the property to GECC as agent for the lender group and any holders of obligations. Obligations was a defined term in the agreement, and it essentially meant all obligations, whether existing or in the future, owing to GECC or any of its affiliates, arising in connection with what's called bank products. Bank products essentially were all advances, debts, liabilities owing to GECC or any of its affiliates and not evidenced by a loan document. General Electric Capital Retail Bank is a separate corporation, is an affiliate, and it's referred to in the briefs as Money Bank, and I'll refer to it here as Money Bank. So what this loan agreement did is it set up a mechanism for GECC to enforce a security interest, not only on behalf of itself, but on behalf of its affiliate.
Well, let me interrupt
with,
you there.
With reference to bank products.
If I may, Mr. Troutman.
Sure.
Because I think what you just said assumes kind of, frankly, the biggest issue I have in this case.
Sure.
Let's assume for purposes of our argument today that walking through the documents, you can establish that GECC held a security interest for the benefit of Money Bank.
Yes.
You make that argument. I'll tell you in candor, I think you have a decent argument on that, and I'll tell it to your colleagues. Where I get a little stuck is what you just kind of assume in your question. You assume that because that once GEC holds a security interest for GEMB's benefit, it has the right to enforce. I'm not 100% sure of the basis for that argument. Why, just you may hold it, but there's a whole bunch of law that says you have to have at least this partial assignment of the right to enforce. Why does it, let's assume then that you hold the interest, security interest, GECC holds the interest for Money Bank. Walk me through your analysis to how that means GECC has the right to enforce Money Bank's interests.
Okay.
Was my question clear?
Yes, it is, and I was just going to get to that point.
Okay.
So, and I need to go to the second agreement that's relevant here to answer your question, if I
sure.
may. What happens in January of 2006, essentially, is UAP conveys its property to its affiliate, WREP, and in that essentially joins the loan agreement so that you now have co-borrowers, UAP and WREP. The effect of that, those two agreements, is that as I've argued, WREP has granted the same security interest that to GECC for the benefit of Money Bank. But more importantly, both UAP and WREP have essentially consented to the enforcement mechanism that is provided for in the loan agreement. And that enforcement mechanism is that GECC can enforce the security interest on behalf of the lender group and on behalf of its affiliates, if it's a bank product. And so without regard to any assignment, there is essentially an agreement by the debtors here that, yes, GECC, you can go forward and you can enforce that. So in essence, they've agreed to stand.
Where does Moneybank say you can enforce my rights on my behalf?
Well, I'm not sure that's required.
Okay. Tell me, explain that to me.
How about third-party beneficiary? Black letter law from 100 years ago in New York is that if you've created a beneficiary that either the original contract party can enforce or the third-party beneficiary can enforce. And so it is, this is classically a third-party beneficiary situation.
There's Has no, that been argued anywhere? I don't recall that in the brief, and if I'm missing it, I apologize.
I don't know that we used the word third-party beneficiary, but there clearly was the argument made that these agreements together provided for the ability of GECC to enforce on behalf of its affiliate.
Mr. Troutman, my impression is that you're now asserting that there was a right to enforce without using the word assignment. In fact, you just said it doesn't necessarily have to be an assignment, if I understand you correctly.
That's correct.
But my understanding also is that the trial court judge focused his analysis on the lack of an assignment
Yes.
among all of the agreements.
Yes.
So did you argue in the trial court what you're arguing before us today?
Yes, I did. I didn't, but counsel did on behalf of my client. And specifically, if you look at the briefs in that case, the argument that I just made, which is that the loan agreement in combination with the joinder agreement provides for GECC to enforce on behalf of Moneybank.
But doesn't your argument assume that the program agreement qualified as a bank product? I think your opponent's arguing that it doesn't.
Yes, it does. And it is a bank product. There, it essentially falls into that definition. And we've set forth in our reply brief, the only argument that they've made is that this was a credit card agreement and therefore it was excluded from the bank product. But if you look at the definition, the very specific definition, it wasn't all credit card agreements. It was only a credit card agreement with a processor, and it had to involve GECC and a processor, neither of which we have here. And if you look at the program agreement, it is not that type of a credit card agreement. So yes, this is a bank product. Let me get back to the assignment question, because there was, and my argument here is also the same, which is, even if you don't agree with me, that there has to, that just looking at the loan agreement, that's sufficient, that the debtor has conceded, if you will, that they're standing for GECC to enforce on behalf of Moneybank. Even if you don't buy that, there is evidence in this record that, again, looking at a different agreement, which was the intercreditor agreement, that there was, in essence, an acknowledgement by the parties here, GECC and Moneybank, that GECC was going to enforce the agreement on behalf of Moneybank. And so if there's a missing link, that missing link is provided by the intercreditor agreement.
So are those, when you're, the language you refer to in the intercreditor agreement, you look at the, you cite to the definition of enforcement action and the like, I can understand why that tends to show an intention of what the part, you know, of the parties here to
Right.
enforce. Is your argument that this is evidence of what the parties intended versus it's evidence of an assignment, or is it both?
It's both.
Okay, why is it, why does that evince an assignment, or we'll call it an assignment, why does it evince some kind of assignment of Moneybank of the right to enforce?
We keep using the word assignment, and the trial judge made a mistake in saying there had to be a full assignment, and I
Right.
think we've established, and I think they've conceded, that all that's required is authorization, okay? And so the authorization, we think, is found in the words of the intercreditor agreement, because it, first of all, it mentions the loan agreement. It mentions the essentially the dividing up, if you will, of proceeds that come in that are owed to both GECC as lender and owed to Moneybank as the holder of a bank product. And it essentially is a authorization. Doesn't use the word assignment, but it's a sufficient authorization contractually, if that's required as a matter of law, to satisfy that requirement.
Well, the New York law does seem to suggest, I agree with you, you don't have to have magic word assignment. I think the cases say that. But you have to have some indication of authorization. I can understand your argument as to why this shows an intent for MoneyBank to have authorized GECC. What I'm not necessarily seeing is the language that says you're authorized to go pursue these on my behalf. Can you help me? What specific language does the authorization as opposed to the intent to do it? It may well be the parties intended to do it, just they didn't do it. They didn't write it down the way they intended. That happens. So that's what I'm having a little trouble making that link.
Okay, well, I think the definition of enforcement action is all that's really required. If you look at that definition, it clearly, and MoneyBank is part of that agreement, that definition says that it covers situations where there is an enforcement action by the bank as agent on behalf of itself or on behalf of somebody like MoneyBank. I think that's the language, that's the magic language that perhaps you're looking for. Other than that, I'm not sure there is anything else. I would like to reserve my remaining time. Thank you.
You have just over 4 minutes, Mr. Troutman.
May it please the court, Ben Cohen, Colorado Bar number 26511, arguing on behalf of the appellee WREP. With me at council table is Ryan Warren, trial counsel below.
Feel free to raise that podium. It's on the bottom right. You'll see arrows up and down if you need to.
I'll
look like you're
mic.
Bending
Thank
over
you.
A little.
I'm fine. Your honors, the documents in this case are pretty massive and they are extraordinarily complex. And I appreciate, I can tell from the beginning of this oral argument that the court's familiar with them, but I'm just gonna walk you through them real quick because you haven't lived with them the way that we have. Now, the first agreement is the private label credit card agreement. This big, it's between Ultimate Electronics, or UAP, and GE Money Bank. It's not even between GECC and WREP, but this is the debt that GECC claims is secured by WREP's property. It has a no third party beneficiary provision right in here, as the trial court noted correctly. It's not signed by WREP. It has a section in here titled security. Makes no mention of WREP or WREP's property. Nothing about the credit card agreement suggests that GECC can collect the debt that's owed to MoneyBank under this, or that this debt is secured by WREP's property. The way to normally secure a debt with property is through a deed of trust or a mortgage. This is the deed of trust. It is similarly large and complex, and it makes absolutely no mention. It says basically the WREP pledges its property to secure debts owed under the loan agreement. It makes no mention whatsoever of the GE Money Bank credit card agreement. The normal way to secure the GE Money Bank debt would be to include that debt in the deed of trust. It's not there, no mention of it at all. That takes us to the loan agreement. If you print it out from the record, it is indeed this large, over 400 pages. It's got 40 pages of definitions. Now, this loan agreement could do the job if GE Money Bank had joined as a lender. The reason this is so big is because it's really not just a loan agreement, it's sort of a meta loan agreement. GECC prepared this and it deliberately abstracted the level. It doesn't just say that GECC...
What evidence do you have of deliberately abstracted? You had this throughout your whole brief, and I have to tell you, Mr. Cohen, it troubled me. I find, Alec, you know, that struck me as just a personal attack on the other side, and I don't get the purpose of it. It's not helpful. to me to tell me they deliberately made it obtuse. You said they did it so courts will just rely on them. There's no basis for argument like that. It's, you know, with all due respect, it doesn't help. It doesn't help to suggest a court is not going to do its job. We all work very hard. So I'd appreciate if we can move on by the histrionics here about how big the agreement is, and let's focus on the issues. And let me focus you on the same issue I focused Mr. Troutman. I want you to assume with me for a minute that if you walk through the documents, you at least could get to the point of concluding that GECC held a security interest on Moneybank's behalf. Make that assumption with me if you would. Does that alone suggest that there is a right to enforce? Just the right that they held the interest on Moneybank's behalf. If we get there, does GECC have the right to enforce on behalf of Moneybank?
No, Your Honor. And that's why the trial judge, I think quite correctly, took the two summary judgment motions that we had filed and focused on the issue of assignment or authorization or standing. And we agree that you can frame that any of those ways, but it is glaringly absent here.
Well, tell me why.
Okay.
So I don't have to keep interrupting you. Let me raise two questions with you. One, I'd be interested in hearing why, if they have the right to enforce on Moneybank's behalf, if they hold the security interest on Moneybank's behalf, why don't they have the right to enforce that interest? That's question one. Question two is, do we get a fact question? Because this was summary judgment. Do we have at least a fact question as to whether there's a right to enforce based on the definition of enforcement action that talks about, you know, that may arguably suggest an intent? There was the recitals in one of the other documents kind of suggested a right to maybe the program agreement, this intent. So do we have a fact question at least? If we have the right to holding security interest on Moneybank's behalf, do we at least have a fact question? So I've talked too long, I apologize. The two questions, if they hold a security interest on Moneybank's behalf, do they have a right to enforce? You say no, I'd like to know why not. And why don't we have at least a fact question?
To answer that question, Your Honor, in the loan agreement is not just GECC loaning money to UAP. It is GECC or any number of other lenders loaning money to UAP and any number of other borrowers, all of whom might join the agreement. If GE Moneybank had joined the agreement, then this would have worked for GECC, because then GE Moneybank would have been a lender, and there is a provision in the loan agreement where the lenders authorize GECC to act as their agent. That was the position that GECC had advanced in the trial court. We're the agent. We can collect because we've been appointed the agent. But it falls apart when you run the definition of agent, of lender, to ground. Because you see, when you do that in the loan agreement, that GE Moneybank didn't join as a lender. There was only one lender, and it's GECC. So there is no assignment or authorization anywhere in the loan agreement by GE Moneybank. GE Moneybank didn't join this loan agreement. Now, counsel has argued that, well, the authorization can be found in the intercreditor agreement, but that's not correct, Your Honor. If you read the intercreditor agreement closely, like the trial court did, you realize what it says is that GE Moneybank, in the event of an enforcement action, which is if UAP declares bankruptcy and GECC, it says basically GECC, if GECC collects money in a UAP bankruptcy on its own behalf, collects money for itself, then GECC will share some of that money with its affiliate GE Moneybank. And it specifically says that sharing, which is based on a complex ratio of the loans pari passu, but that sharing does not reduce the amount of money that that UAP owes under the credit card agreement. So it can't be a collection.
Mr. Cohn, what was the purpose of that sharing agreement sharing provision of the intercreditor agreement?
Well, that purpose was an arrangement, a separate financial arrangement between GECC and GE Moneybank that WREP was not a party to.
I understand that, but what was the purpose of it?
It appears from its face, Your Honor, that the purpose was for GECC, which would be the one party emerging from a UAP bankruptcy with money in its pocket, to help out its affiliate, to cover its affiliate, if you will, throw them a bone, but to make sure that they've got some money emerging from this situation. But it is not an authorization to collect. because it specifically states that the balance of the credit card agreement does not change, and GE Money Bank can still collect against UAP. And if it does, then GE Money Bank's got to give the money back that it accepted under the intercreditor agreement. So that is why it is not and cannot be an authorization to collect. That's why the trial court focused on the standing issue on GECC's authorization and found that it was lacking in any of these documents. And it's similarly lacking even if you construe them all together. Now, I do want to emphasize, Your Honors, that this the trial court did, I think, a thorough and excellent job of rolling up the sleeves of its robe and analyzing all of these documents. And I believe the trial court got it right. And if this court, as it obviously is willing to do, dives into them and looks at the documents with the same, puts them under the microscope the same way or reach the same conclusions. I do know, however, that you don't have to do that if you don't want to, because this is a classic situation where appellate waiver allows you to dispose of this case without having to go there, because GECC's new argument on appeal that you can find some sort of assignment or authorization by viewing the documents together, a composite document theory, was an issue that GECC did not raise below.
How is it different when they raised the whole argument below? I guess they didn't use the word composite. I think I accept that. My memory is they didn't. But they said you have to read all the documents together. Isn't it exactly the same argument they're making now? And if not, why not?
They argued that the below specific arguments were first the GECC was agent for all was agent for GEMB, but that fell apart when we realized that GEMB Money Bank wasn't a lender. Then they made an argument based on res judicata, based on a Delaware bankruptcy court ruling that they've abandoned, although that is quite telling that what was the primary argument below they're not even re-raising on appeal. Then they made the argument that they are making here, which is that the intercreditor agreement can be construed as offering some kind of authorization. I don't believe that they ever made the argument that it's not, you won't see the authorization in any one particular document, but it emerges when you view all three documents or all of the documents together. That specific theory or formulation was not offered to the trial court. And Colorado law is quite explicit that arguments or theories that are not raised below cannot be raised on it for the first time on appeal, especially in a situation like this, where GECC was facing summary judgment. An argument was laid out that showed there was no authorization to collect, and so the burden shifted onto GECC. You can't raise, put on half your case, and then put on the rest of it on appeal.
So, Mr. Cohn, the trial court discussed each of these different agreements, and I gather your position is that the trial court discussed each of them separately, but not together.
The trial court did, of course, acknowledge that the agreements were interrelated. They used definitions. For instance, the intercreditor agreement uses the definitions from the loan agreement. So the trial court very carefully parsed the definitions and ran them all to ground. So he did, in effect, interpret the loan agreement against the back, no, he interpreted the intercreditor agreement against the backdrop of the loan agreement. So we will give you that. But the argument that somehow an intent emerges from these documents that doesn't adhere in any one particular document was an argument that was never made below. The trial court's analysis was nonetheless correct in that he looked at the loan agreement, he interpreted it correctly by using the definition at the intercreditor agreement, correctly used the definitions from the loan agreement. And in that sense, you could say that he interpreted them together. But that was just what he needed to do in order to understand what the loan agreement was really saying. Thank you. A couple things that I would like to briefly emphasize. There was a question from Judge Boris about whether the credit card agreement is a bank product, because that is where their argument for security, which they would have to establish on appeal, since you can affirm on any basis. It adheres in this notion that the credit card agreement was a bank product. It is not a bank product, or rather the GE Money Bank agreement is not a bank product, because it is a credit card agreement. And if GECC has authority, presuming arguendo, which we disagree that, but if GECC, as you presume that it has authority to collect this, then the GE Money Bank agreement is indeed a credit card agreement, that's what it is, among GECC, GEMB, and UAP. It does satisfy the definition.
Is GEMB a credit card processor in this definition and the argument you just made?
I think it is.
Okay.
It is the bank that handles, that produces these private label credit cards. It makes perfect sense. There are also other ways of viewing this, and I want to just throw out that the GE Money Bank Agreement fails the definition of being a bank product, because remember, a bank product is not it's not a bank product if it's evidenced by a loan document. So if there's any loan document that evidences the credit card agreement, it ceases to be under their definitions. The intercreditor agreement makes the money bank agreement, the credit card agreement, a loan document. It is a, where's the definition of loan document? It's quite complex, but basically in the intercreditor agreement, GEMB and GECC put the documents on a table that says references made to the loan agreement and to the credit card agreement. So GECC, GEMB is effectively delivering the credit card agreement to GECC by saying references made to both of them, and then it makes a transaction, an arrangement in the intercreditor agreement about how they're going to divvy up funds that are collected. That meets the definition of loan document, and it thereby makes the credit card agreement a loan document, which means that it's not a bank product. If the court runs those definitions to ground, I think it'll see that that is the case. Your Honors, the trial court's opinion was very well reasoned. The trial judge put these documents under a microscope. I'll submit that the trial court's opinion was so well reasoned that GECC made a deliberate decision not to seek any kind of rehearing or reconsideration, but decided rather than give this to Judge Kuznowski for further review, and it had a year to do that, it would take its best shot up here with what amounts to a new theory. Your Honors, the new theory does not pan out. We urge you to review all of the documents, review all of the arguments, and when you do, I think you'll agree that the issues were raised, waived, the trial court decided the issue correctly, and that this court should affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cohen.
May it please the court, with respect to whether this was raised below, I'll just tell you that if you look at plaintiff GE Capital's opposition to the motion for summary judgment, the argument is made that GECC and Money Bank independently agreed in the intercreditor agreement to establish an agency relationship, etc. And we went through this in our reply brief. Everything that we're arguing here is argued there. The problem is we didn't anticipate that the judge would not look at the agreements together, and therefore, yes, we didn't use the word composite because we didn't know that he would ignore that. Let me focus what I think are the concerns of the court.
Mr. Trump, I don't want to interrupt your head of steam, but would you just answer a quick question for me before you jump into what you wanted to say? Under the definition of credit card agreement, is Money Bank a credit card processor?
Absolutely not.
Okay, could you explain why?
Well, it talks about processing receipts, but there are no receipts. The other requirement that's not met is that it has to be an agreement with GECC. It's not an agreement with GECC, it's an agreement with Money Bank. And if you just read it, all it really does is, if you went into an Ultimate Electronics and you bought a television, you filled out a credit application, and essentially Money Bank would advance the money to the consumer so they could buy the television. It's not the kind of credit card that a MasterCard or Visa, that type of card, which does have specifically processing of receipts.
Thank you.
Now back to my head of steam. The issues that I think the court is concerned about is really the question of whether or not there's enough language in the intercreditor agreement to find that there was this authorization. And I pointed out the enforcement action language. I would also point out that in each one of the definitions, it talks about the agreement referring to the loan agreement. It essentially incorporates the loan agreement. It incorporates the definition of agent. An agent is the situation where GECC is collecting on the behalf of Money Bank. And so if you take all of that together in the intercreditor agreement, it's clear that the parties, in this case, GECC and Money Bank, were under the impression that that there was authorization on behalf of GECC to collect on behalf of Money Bank. Secondly, with regard to the program agreement, the program agreement also references the loan agreement. And so, and it specifically says that they were entering into the loan agreement in reliance on the fact that there was a security interest, that this was not going to be an unsecured loan, and it referenced the loan agreement itself. So I think that, you know, even if you don't think that they got the words exactly right, there's at least an issue of fact here, Your Honor. And this was a grant of summary judgment. So we don't think you need to remand it because we do think that if you walk through it, you can find that these documents are clear enough, lack enough, or have a clear enough definitions that you can find that there was both this enforceable security interest and there was authorization on behalf of Money Bank to GECC to enforce. And so we would ask you to simply reverse, but if you find that there's a factual issue on intent, and intent can be, if there is an ambiguity, that you remand. So we would ask that you do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chapman. Thank you, Mr. Cohen. Again, we appreciate both of your very fine arguments this morning. Thank you, Mr. Warren, for your presence this morning, too. We appreciate it. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.